We need more self-driving car regulations. The town that banned Bitcoin. How to design low-tech gadgets in a high-tech world. Zuckerberg's apology tour. And Jeff Bezos' new dog. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 24, recorded Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/TWiT. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at RocketMortgage.com/TWiT. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk about the people breaking and making and analyzing and podcasting about the news of the week. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is on vacation, but I am excited to talk to four fantastic guests. Let's get started. This week, pedestrian Elaine Herzberg was killed after stepping into the path of a self-driving Uber. This is the first pedestrian death from a self-driving car, but probably it will not be the last. First report said the crash was unavoidable, but now that police have released the video of the interior and exterior of the car, many are calling those first reports into question. Joining us to discuss the crash and the state of self-driving car regulations is Sam Abu al-Samed, host of the Wheel Bearings podcast, analyst at Navigant Research, and contributor to Ford's. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Hey, Megan. Great to be back on again.
So first off, I'm going to say we're not going to show the video of the crash. You can check Sam's article. He has the tweet from the police. You can Google it. You can see it. I believe it's disturbing, so you can make that choice on your own. But Sam, describe a little bit for those who haven't seen it or don't want to see it. Describe a high level of what that dash cam video showed.
Yeah, so the big thing about this video is that it actually tells quite a different story from what we first heard from the police on Monday. It shows the view looking forward out of the car as it's going down this road in Tempe. And the description we got on Monday was that the woman who was struck and killed suddenly, jumped out in front of the vehicle, jumped out of the shadows. And that's actually not at all what's on this video. In fact, what we see is that the car was going down the right hand lane on this street in Tempe of a four lane divided roadway. So it was two lanes in each direction with a median in the middle. And she was crossing over from left to right. So she had already been in the roadway for several seconds. She'd crossed over about 1.5 lanes of the roadway. And there's no other traffic around. It was a clear night. Granted, there was no lighting on that street, so it was pretty dark and she had fairly dark clothes on. But nonetheless, she was out in the open where the sensors of an autonomous vehicle should have very easily been able to pick her up and detect her from a distance of anywhere from 150 to 300 feet, depending on the type of sensors they're using. And at the speed that the car was going, there was also no one in the left-hand lane. So at the speed the car was, the Uber vehicle was going, about 38 miles an hour, it should have been able to come to a complete stop in about 60 to 70 feet once it detected her, which means that it's possible that if it had properly detected her presence in the roadway, that the vehicle could have applied the brakes and come to a complete stop or moved over into the left-hand lane and missed her entirely. So this, contrary to what the police said, this was appears to have been an entirely avoidable accident. We actually had two very different failure modes in this situation. One was a failure of Uber's autonomous driving system that failed to detect her or failed to respond properly. We don't know which yet until we see the logs from the car. And the other was a failure of the safety driver system. Most of the companies that are testing these vehicles have safety drivers in the vehicle. And when they're driving around, what they're supposed to do is have their hands on their lap right by the steering wheel, ready to grab the steering wheel at any time as they watch the road and look for any kind of anomalies. You know, if the vehicle looks like it's about to do something it shouldn't, they're supposed to grab the wheel and take control. And the second half of the video posted by the police department shows the interior camera view of the safety driver. And most of the time, you know, for that 15 seconds or so of the video, the driver was looking down. You know, we don't know if you're looking at a phone or looking at a data screen in the car, but whatever it was, the driver was not looking at the road, not paying attention until the very last moment when just before the impact.
So, yeah, it's we've heard this story about the safety car for a couple of years now, the safety driver, just the fact that, you know, psychologically you're either driving or you're not driving. There's not an in-between necessarily. And so I think this is that part of proving this point that, like, once you know you're not actually driving a car, you're not going to be paying attention at all enough to stop something if the technology goes wrong.
Yeah, that's absolutely a real problem. You know, testing by various automakers has shown that, you know, for the so-called level three automated, semi-automated systems, what they call conditional automation, where the driver is allowed to stop paying attention to the road. If the system has to hand off control back to the driver, it can take up to 10 seconds for the driver to respond and be completely engaged again and take control of the vehicle. And that's a real problem. You know, and this, you know, this instance, this incident on Sunday night is a prime example of what can happen. You know, if you've got a human that is nominally supposed to be paying some degree of attention to the road and be ready to take over, and they don't, you know, the reality is, you know, when the system works okay for a long enough period of time, you very quickly become complacent, and you're not going to be paying the level of attention that you need to be able to take over control quickly.
So let's get to the technology of it. So this was, you write in your article, this was very basic, that the LiDAR should have been able to see the bicyclist in the dark or in the light through the headlights or no, but it failed. Do we have any idea why that part failed?
That we don't know yet. So these Uber vehicles, like most of the autonomous vehicles, prototype vehicles on the road, are equipped with three main types of sensors. Cameras that are used for looking at things like lane markings and doing image detection, being able to detect the difference between other vehicles, animals, pedestrians, you know, just general objects on the road, traffic signals, and then radar sensors, which are really good at detecting the distance and speed to an object. And radar works great. You know, radar is great because it can see through fog and other conditions that cameras and LiDAR can't. And then LiDAR kind of falls in the middle, generating, you know, you've got a laser that scans around the area and generates a point cloud of all the objects, all the other road users, and can also detect the distance to those objects and the speed that those objects are moving at. So, you know, between those three, you have some overlap, but they also all have weaknesses. So cameras don't work very well in low light conditions, as you know. You know, radar doesn't give you a clear image of what the object is, only how far away it is and how quickly it's moving. And LiDAR, you know, is kind of in between. So there's overlap, which is good for redundancy. So if any one system fails, you've still got information from the others that you can work with. And unfortunately, you know, we don't know at this point, you know, until we probably won't know until the National Transportation Safety Board is done with their investigation and they look at the data from the vehicle to figure out, you know, was it a failure of the sensing system, the detection system, or the control system that's supposed to respond to what the sensors see? And that's, you know, that's something we're just going to have to wait on.
So there are all kinds of like semi self-driving cars on the road now. I know there's all kinds of programs. There's, you know, one where I think it's by Google or Waymo where, you know, families have access to these self-driving cars and, you know, with a safety driver and they'll drive them wherever they want, which I just remember that one because it seems like heaven getting my kids everywhere they need to go and not having to be behind the wheel. What was this? Was this what kind of car was this? And were they just kind of like trying to get a certain amount of hours on the road? Because isn't that how they can prove that they're safe, by saying, well, we've driven so many hours? Or was this guy, where were they going? Was it an Uber working as an Uber driver?
At this point, again, we don't know. Uber has not said, you know, exactly what the vehicle was doing out there. Most likely, excuse me, it was just accumulating miles, looking for, you know, various situations. As far as we know, it was not on duty picking up passengers, which, you know, some of the Uber vehicles in the Phoenix area have been doing. We don't think that that was the case in this one, you know, just given the time of night, you know, 10 p.m. on a Sunday night. It was unlikely that it was picking up passengers. So it was probably just accumulating miles. But, you know, as you said, there are various pilot programs going on. Waymo has a pilot program, again, in the Phoenix area near where Uber is. Their early rider program where they've signed up families to participate in a ride hailing service with Waymo's automated Chrysler Pacificas. Newtonomy has a pilot program in Boston. Aptiv is in Las Vegas. And there's others around the world as well. And we're going to see more and more of these over the next couple of years as companies build out both the services and the technology.
Okay, so what are the minimum performance standards for self-driving vehicles? Well, what do they have to have before they're allowed out on the road?
Right now, there really aren't any. That's part of the problem. You know, in Arizona, Governor Doug Ducey recently issued an updated executive order basically saying that, you know, these vehicles need to comply with state and federal regulations. But that's about it. But there aren't any regulations specific to autonomous vehicles in Arizona. So basically, anybody can go register a vehicle and start driving it on the roads in Arizona. California is a little more strict in that you have to pay a $150 registration fee and you have to submit an annual report on disengagements of the system, how often the safety driver had to take over. But as far as the performance of the vehicles themselves go, there aren't any regulations nationally or at the state level. And that's something that needs to change. And, you know, if you think about it today, you or I, if we want to get a driver's license, we have to go down to the DMV. First thing they do is they give us a vision test, make sure that you can see and recognize things like pedestrians and bicyclists and other vehicles and traffic signs and know what they are. And then, you know, take a test of basic, you know, rules of the road and understand. When you see a pedestrian, what are you going to do? Are you going to run it over? Are you going to slow down and stop? Are you going to go around it? And there is none of that for autonomous vehicles. You know, John Krafcek, the CEO of Waymo, you know, has often described it as having a virtual driver in the vehicle. Well, if we're replacing a human driver with a virtual driver, why wouldn't we expect the virtual driver to meet at least the same, you know, baseline standard as a human driver? You know, verify that it can see, verify that it knows the basic rules of the road. You don't have to specify what technology they use, but, you know, it needs to have some really fundamental things before you put it on the road with other people. And I think, you know, now's the time, you know, well, I think it's actually past time, but, you know, I think now we're finally starting to get some conversation about defining what are those standards. You know, an autonomous vehicle, you know, should probably be able to detect a pedestrian or a cyclist at, you know, a certain distance, maybe 100 feet, you know, in any lighting conditions in daylight or darkness or rain. And if it can't do that, you know, then it can't go on the road. If it can't do it reliably, it can't go on the road. And you know, if we do that, if we set up those standards, then even though the federal government is not going to do any new regulations at least for the duration of this administration, states which are responsible for licensing and registration, they can license virtual drivers and use the same kind of standards we use for humans. Verify that you can see and verify that you know the basic rules of the road.
Mm-hmm. And verify you can see a pedestrian and a cyclist and a pedestrian who's walking a bike, because, I mean, there's some, you know, maybe that was the issue, that it didn't look like a cyclist or a pedestrian because she was walking her bike.
Well, I mean, either way, you know, even if you couldn't necessarily distinguish that it was a human being walking a bike, you still know that there's an object in the path of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And the vehicle did not change its trajectory based on the fact that there was something in front of it, you know, a solid object in front of it, regardless of what it was. And that's not a good thing. You know, the fact that Uber had a vehicle that allowed that to happen. And, you know, unfortunately with Uber in particular, you know, we've seen a number of videos pop up over the last couple of years showing their vehicles making all kinds of mistakes. when during their brief stay in San Francisco in December of 2016. They were only there for a day and a half before the state of California kicked them out, and they went to Arizona. And we saw in that time, we saw at least a couple of videos pop up of Uber's vehicles running red lights and having near misses with other vehicles. And then, you know, there was another accident in Tempe that didn't have any injuries, but it was an accident several months ago. And now this one, you know, so I think Uber, I think, is struggling with their automated driving program. And this is just another sign of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want self-driving cars to come as quickly as possible. But I too, would like to see some state regulation. And I think you're the man to push it forward, Sam.
I will do my best.
Sam Abu al-Samad is analyst at Navigant Research, and some, me, have called him the Ralph Nader of the self-driving car industry. Thank you so much for joining us, Sam.
Thank you, Megan. Have a great day.
You too. Back in January, citizens of Plattsburgh, New York, began to see their electricity bills skyrocket. When the mayor looked into it, he found that two Bitcoin mining operations consumed about 10% of the city's power resources and were causing the rest of the residents' traditionally low energy costs to go up. Joining us to talk about how the problem came to be and what the mayor is doing about it is Daniel Oberhaus, staff writer at Motherboard. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you start by explaining why, first of all, electricity costs in Plattsburgh were so low to begin with?
Yeah, so for a few decades, the city of Plattsburgh has had an agreement with a consortium of other towns in the area to draw their power from a hydroelectric dam in upstate New York. So this kind of gave them super cheap electricity. They were paying about 4.5 cents for residents per kilowatt hour, whereas, you know, the rest of the country pays around 12 cents on average. So they were paying about, you know, one third of what the rest of the country has to pay.
And so they wanted people to come. They were trying to, I mean, every town wants businesses to come. So they were trying to, they had a former paper mill and, you know, what better use than a Bitcoin mining operation? So they knew that these people were coming. Did they just not know how much energy they were going to use?
I'm not sure they did know they were coming. Plattsburgh is very much a post-industrial town, so they used to have a lot of industry there that has since moved either overseas or, you know, elsewhere in the U.S. And a couple of citizens, I think, realized that this cheap electricity provided a, you know, very unique opportunity to mine Bitcoin, which is a very energy intensive computing process. And shortly thereafter, 2 years later, a large international mining company also caught wind of this and moved in. And that's when the residents kind of started to notice that their energy was becoming more expensive as a result of this. So I think it kind of took them by surprise, and that's why they wanted to take legislative action to kind of put a halt to that.
Oh. So I have an idea of what a former paper mill looks like, but is it just full of computers? Like, what? How does a Bitcoin mining operation work?
Yeah, so in Plattsburgh, there are two main locations. One of them is in the former paper mill, which is kind of just a large industrial building. It's still mostly empty. There's one small Bitcoin mine there that has about 100 Bitcoin miners in it. And then the largest Bitcoin mine in Plattsburgh is actually located in a strip mall across town, right next to a dollar store in this old, it used to be a comics distributor. And so now it's just this kind of faceless building. And you would really have no idea that there was a Bitcoin mine there unless you went around back where there's a bunch of large fans and you can really hear the machines kind of humming along.
I would love for someone to go to that dollar store and ask how much something costs in Bitcoin. That would be to me. So they used so much power that then everybody's costs went up. And what did the mayor do after everyone complained that they were paying what everyone else was paying for energy costs?
Yeah, so in January, a lot of the citizens started writing to the mayor complaining about energy costs going up anywhere from $40 to, you know, above $200 per person. So pretty significant increases in their energy bills. And this prompted the mayor to essentially draft up a bill that would put a 18-month moratorium on Bitcoin mining in the city to kind of give the town some breathing room to figure out how to regulate this new industry, because on the one hand, they don't really want to scare away new technology development in the city. But on the other hand, as the mayor told us when we went to go visit, they already have several Bitcoin mining operations, large scale ones that want to move into the town. So they could easily use up their entire allotment of electricity within 2 months, he said. So they just wanted to, kind of put the brakes on this, figure out how to regulate this effectively so that the residents don't lose access to this super cheap utility that they've had for decades.
And do you get the idea that the miners, these mining operations, would pay the extra? I mean, I think that I read in your story that they said they would. But, I mean, isn't Bitcoin so fluctuate so much? Like, is it possible that they would say, oh, yes, we'll pay, and then skip town?
Yeah, that's a tough question, because the smaller Bitcoin mining operation, which is smaller by about a factor of 10, so much smaller, but the second largest one, they said they were more than willing to pay increased electricity costs. The larger Bitcoin mining operation, which is run by a Puerto Rican company called CoinMint, they aren't as good as engaging with the public. So it's unclear how electricity costs would affect them. I did some back of the napkin calculations on how much they could be expecting to make at current Bitcoin prices, and it looks like they're making well over $1 million a month in profit right now. I can't confirm this because they won't give any numbers on how many mines they have in their facility or how much they're making, but based on their power draw, that's what you can expect them to be making. So I don't think a energy hike would affect their profits that much. So I don't think that would drive them out of town.
And are they giving jobs to the town, or is it really just computers?
That's kind of the major point of contention, is that these Bitcoin mines draw as much energy or actually way more energy than large industrial operations, but they don't actually provide many jobs. So CoinMint, the large operation there, didn't actually provide any numbers on how many people they employ full-time officially there. Their representative, when I spoke to him, said he didn't know, which I found a bit odd. But when we spoke to an employee who just happened to be outside of the mine when we went to visit, he said that they only employ himself and about two other people full-time in the mine, which, when you compare that to a large industrial operation that Plattsburgh actually wants to attract that might employ, say, several hundred people and use a fifth of the energy, that's kind of a major concern for the city.
Yeah, it seems like this is a story that we're going to be following for a while in other towns as well. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg and the politics of Facebook. But you also posted a piece on Motherboard this week about how to delete your Facebook account. So I wanted to get some tips, because by the end of the week, I'm going to do this. And I've actually downloaded everything from my Facebook account before. It's this giant file. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been able to pull the trigger. Now, before we started, have you deleted your Facebook account, or just told other people how to do it?
I have. I deleted it shortly before posting the article, so it's not fake news, I guess.
Okay, and so you're still living, you're still breathing, you seem yeah. still alive. Have your family and friends disowned you?
I actually hadn't been using Facebook that often before deleting it, so it wasn't that big of a transition for me. I've had several people reach out, though, and, say that they took action on the advice. I think Mark Zuckerberg actually just came out yesterday and said he hasn't seen a significant number of people deleting their Facebook, which, could be PR spin, could be anything, but I've definitely seen a positive response to this. It sounds like people are surviving after deleting it, so, life after Facebook is possible.
So did you go through the whole process and download everything? And how long have you been on Facebook?
I joined Facebook probably about 8 years ago at this point. So I did download everything. I would say it probably took about an hour and a half to get all the photos and everything off of there. It is a bit of an involved process. I don't think it's as hard as people think to get everything off there. I mean, Facebook certainly doesn't make it easy to leave, but... in the article, I listed all the tools. They're freely available, very intuitive to use, and it's mostly just the time it takes to download all your photos.
And did you make a grand announcement on Facebook that you were leaving, or did you just do the Irish goodbye like I do at parties where I just sneak out the back door?
You know, I reached out to a few people who, for whatever reason, I didn't have their contact information and let them know and gave them my phone number. But, you know, most of the people I actually talk to on any sort of regular basis, I already have their information. So, no Grandin Ashman did the Irish goodbye.
Well, you have inspired me, Daniel. I'm going to do it by the end of this week. I have actually not been on Facebook. I've only been on Facebook since I started this job in 2015, because before I was anti-Facebook. And, so I don't have that much. And I think I can remember people's birthdays other ways. So thank you. Daniel Overhaus. Sorry, go ahead. That was it. Okay. Daniel Overhaus is a staff writer at Motherboard, covering cryptocurrency, physics, space, and the future of energy. He is DM Overhaus on Twitter. Thank you so much for coming on, Daniel.
Thank you for having me, Megan.
Take care. After the break, a Kickstarter that raised 3 times its goal in less than 48 hours. And the host of Tech Memes Daily News podcast, Brian McCullough, joins us to talk about Mark Zuckerberg's defense of Facebook. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. LastPass keeps your passwords organized and secure and right at your fingertips. We all have way too many passwords to remember, whether it's managing your personal accounts or securing your workplace credentials. LastPass makes password security effortless. And if you're going to delete Facebook, you're going to have all kinds of login on your own to places. And you don't want to have to memorize all those passwords. You can just remember your master password, and LastPass will remember the rest. If you're reusing the same password over and over again, don't do that. Stop that, please. LastPass generates and stores strong, unique passwords to keep you safe and secure. LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on a computer or on your mobile device. You can easily add, view, and manage items that you've saved. And LastPass Enterprise simplifies password management for companies of every size with the tools you need to secure your business while centralizing control of employee passwords and apps. So if you have a small business or a big business, you should really consider this. Over 81% of breaches are caused by weak passwords. LastPass protects every password in your business without slowing down your employees. They can remember the important stuff about the business. They don't have to remember all these passwords. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. Sensitive data is encrypted at the device level with AES 256 to protect from man-in-the-middle attacks. You know me. I am always trying new apps as part of my job. I have probably tried every password manager out there over the years, and I always, always go back to LastPass. We use the enterprise version here that Leo and Lisa pay for, and I seriously consider it one of my most important employee benefits, right up there with our healthcare coverage. It just feels like I'm more secure, and I love that our business uses it. I am serious. They did not tell me to say that. It is true. And LastPass has other products besides the enterprise for business. There's LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family. This is awesome for sharing passwords among your more forgetful family members. My kids can't even remember their lunch, their backpack, anything like that. I do not trust them to remember passwords. LastPass does that for them. If only LastPass could also remember where they left their backpack, that would be great. LastPass also has LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit, and see which product is right for you. I love my gadgets as much as the next gal, but I also love the low-tech stuff too, including a good old-fashioned pen and paper. I don't go anywhere without my bullet journal, but I've yet to find the perfect pen. Thankfully, two of my favorite designers launched a Kickstarter this week for the Mark One, a custom machined all-metal retractable pen with a ceramic-based exterior. It is not a digital pen, but to say that it is just a pen would not do this pen the justice it deserves. Here to tell us about it is Dan Provost, co-founder of Studio Neat and co-creator of the Mark One. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
So first things first, why a pen?
Very good question. I think last year we launched another analog product, a notebook. It's kind of this panoramic notebook called the Panabook that's kind of meant to sit on your desk, either in front of or behind your keyboard. It's like a desk notebook. And so I think that got us kind of going down this old school tools analog path. And that project was a success and did much better than we were expecting. So a pen seemed like the perfect follow-up. So, of course, that's what we did.
Yeah, I have a Panobook. I love it because, yeah, the bullet journal is usually just off to the side and you have to awkwardly reach for it. But with the Panobook, it's just right in front of your computer. It's great.
Exactly.
So you reached your goal really fast. How long did it take you to reach your Kickstarter goal?
It took us about 2 hours since we launched it, which definitely surprised us. I mean, this isn't our first Kickstarter campaign. We've done this many times in the past, but it always surprises us a little bit each time to get a really good response like that. So we're super pumped about it.
So tell us a little bit about the design process. I know this is really important to you. So what can you tell us about how the pen was made?
Sure. So it basically all started with this refill. So the actual ink cartridge that we're using in the pen, it's called a roller ball. It's the Schmidt P8126. And we discovered this refill in a different pen, and we loved the way the ink flowed and how quickly it dried and just what a nice writing experience it was. But we hated the pen that it was in. So we were just like, aha, we should design a pen for this refill. And so that kind of, got us, thinking about it. And of course, the iterative design process. So there were many, 3D prints. We started off, we have a simple MakerBot 3D printer. And then we realized, once we got deeper into the design process, my design partner, Tom, actually bought like a simple metal lathe so we could actually make like the metal bodies and start to iterate on the mechanism. So it's like all of our stuff. It's just about iteration, over and over again until we finally arrive at something we like. And where we're joking, we feel like we designed this product twice because we were pretty satisfied with it. And then we thought, we should take another pass at this mechanism, and we basically completely redesigned the mechanism. So it's definitely been a labor of love, but we're really happy with where we ended up.
I'm really excited about the click mechanism because
yes.
the pen top is such a pain. Who needs that anymore to have to worry about where the pen top is? And plus, it's just something you can do instead of swiping through Facebook, which I'm going to do.
Yeah, the it's a super satisfying click mechanism. I mean, we really, we labored over that. And like I said, we basically designed it twice. And I agree. I mean, I think capped pens definitely have their place, especially if you're going to be like putting it in your pocket. But I definitely think a click mechanism is much better than a twist, which is kind of the other way to do a retractable pen. And just from personal experience, you realize a twist mechanism falls time the first time you're ever talking on the phone and you need to write something down. You can't really untwist a pen with just the other hand. So yeah, for us, it's click was the way to go. So we decided that early on. That was basically the first decision we made, and it was just about how to make a really good version of that mechanism.
So you also created a stylus at one point, the Cosmonaut, a wide grip stylus. Did you use any of the same tools or design with the pen?
Not at all. No. I mean, there's a chance that we will use the same manufacturer because the core of the Cosmonaut is aluminum, and it's like a lathed aluminum piece. So we're kind of getting quotes from different manufacturers here in the U.S., but we could use the same manufacturer, which would be kind of a funny thing. They make some other parts for us too, for the glyph and stuff. So it is interesting. This Cosmonaut was back in 2011. So it's funny that we're returning to writing instruments, but a more low tech variant.
Yeah, I wish that the Apple Pencil looked as good as the Mark One. and didn't have two parts in it. That's the most annoying part, the cover, and I'm always losing it, and et cetera.
Yeah.
So you have a weird collection of products from Studio Neat. I first heard about you because the Canopy, which I use with my iPad Pro, and I love that has a magic keyboard on it. And then you have the Pano Book and the Cosmonaut, and you also have a some things for making cocktails. You have a great app, the Studio Neat app for making cocktails, and some other random things, simple syrup kit. You call yourselves a small batch business. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Right. So that was a term that was coined by Jason Kotke, blogger extraordinaire who just celebrated his 20th anniversary, actually. But we really liked that term because basically to us what it means is we're a company that has kind of made the very intentional decision to stay small. So Studio Neat started basically by accident with just Tom and I, and we remain the only two employees. Like, it's still just two of us. So this is the two of us. So this is a very intentional decision. And what we think that buys us is a real kind of agility and flexibility to make decisions quickly and iterate quickly and not kind of pigeonhole us into like certain markets because, you know, we've grown too big. And so now we have to kind of like stay here. And so it's really fun to kind of, you know, put our finger in the air and see kind of where the wind takes us. And, you know, we've made some missteps. Like our one failed Kickstarter project was like a smartphone controlled laser cat toy, which did not succeed. And so that was like a good lesson of like, okay, maybe we can't be too capricious. We have to kind of, you know, understand who our audience is and things like that. But it's been a lot of fun to just basically listen to kind of our own intuitions and where we see problems in our own lives that maybe design could be a solution there. And so it's a lot of fun, and it's kind of surprising to me that we are able to exist without having necessarily a coherence between products, except, you know, I guess you could ask our customers and they would maybe argue that there is kind of this thread of, you know, simplicity and, you know, good design and stuff. But in terms of the product categories, it's all over the place. So I don't know. It's been fun.
Yeah, I definitely think I like how simple they are. And they're all kind of a way to, you know, you're obviously a tech-ish person and a tech guy. And, you know, and those, we appreciate a certain, I don't know, maybe it's the design aesthetic. I don't know. I probably would also not have backed the cat toy, dog toy perhaps, but, I'm glad that you pivoted from cat toys.
Us too.
So, lots of people, you know, everybody has a novel in them and everybody thinks they have, you know, a problem they can solve, but you know, most of us don't actually go and do it. Like what, you've already given us some good advice on, you know, how you keep it simple and easy, but what advice do you have, for people out there that, you know, like I could do something like that. What would you suggest?
Well, I think it's a really nice time and people should be encouraged where I think there's never been an easier time to do something, to make your idea a reality. So if you just look at, the design process, all the tools we have access to, you know, there's, if you're making a physical product, there's freeware 3D modeling program. You can send your models off to Shapeways or something like that to get it 3D printed a nominal cost. If you're making something digital, obviously there's a plethora of tools for doing that. And then, you know, these things like Kickstarter are just so amazing. You know, bringing an idea into reality if it is successful, but it's also just great idea validation. If nobody backs it, like our laser cactoy, it's like, okay, good. We didn't invest any more time and money into that because we saw that there wasn't a market for it. So I just think people should be encouraged to know that the services and tools and resources that are out there are better than they've ever been and continue to get better. So there's basically never been an easier time than now to get your idea out there. And like I said, if it fails on Kickstarter or whatever, like that's okay too, because you probably saved yourself, you know, a lot of heartbreak down the road. So I don't know. I would encourage people to just, you know, go for it.
All right. So the cost, it's $50 now if you back the Kickstarter, right, for one mm-hmm. pen. And then mm-hmm. eventually it'll be in the $65 range.
Yeah, still to be determined. But yeah, it's probably going to bump up a little bit after Kickstarter. So basically, if you want to get the best deal, then you should jump on the Kickstarter.
Awesome. And we had a question in the chat room. Is it good for lefties? Left-handed.
Yes, it totally is. So that one of the traits of this of the refill we're using is that the ink dries quite quickly. So it is good for that. But the pen takes a style of cartridge that's called a Parker style refill. And so if you're not satisfied with the refill that it ships with, you can swap it out with something that is even better for that case, you know, like a gel or something that dries even quicker. So yeah, it's quite flexible in that regard.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. Dan Provost is the co-founder of Studio Neat with Tom Gerhart, and he is also the co-host of the podcast Thoroughly Considered on Relay FM. And you can find him at Dan Provost on Twitter. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck with the rest of your Kickstarter.
Thanks.
The delete Facebook hashtag is trending on Twitter, that popular social network that hasn't sold all of us out and our friends yet, as far as we know. One person who has not deleted Facebook is Mark Zuckerberg, who posted that it's all Cambridge Analytica's fault, but he also admits responsibility without, however, using the word sorry in his post or the word apologize. But then he came out later, talked to a bunch of people, except for me, and did say sorry. Joining us to discuss this mess is Brian McCullough, internet historian and host of the new podcast, Tech Meme Ride Home. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hi, Megan. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming on. Since you also host the Internet History Podcast, I want you to lay out the timeline of the events in this saga, starting with the beginning of the internet.
Well, with the beginning of the internet, the timeline is actually pretty funny because of the Tech Meme show, because we post that every day at 5 p.m. Eastern. So Friday of last week, this news broke that Facebook was suspending Cambridge Analytica. And of course, that's 4 hours after I posted my show. So, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of a Friday news dump, of course, is that hopefully the news that you're trying to dump will be forgotten by Monday. But I don't know if you noticed this, but man, over the weekend, this story just metastasized. Like, there was just an angle that people could come up with for everything about this. I mean, of course, the angle is Cambridge Analytica, you know, worked for the Trump campaign, worked for the pro-Brexit vote campaign. So then there's the whole angle of Russian meddling with the election and things like that. Then there was also just sort of the angle that the whole reason that Facebook suddenly announced this on Friday night was that they knew that there were two stories in the New York Times and the Guardian that were about to come out with a, quote, whistleblower that was going to talk about all of the ways that Cambridge Analytica got this data off of Facebook via a professor named Alexander Kogan, who created that, you know, those apps that you see, take this quiz and we'll tell you, I don't know, you're a perfect Libra or something. You know, there's a million of those. When the articles post over the weekend, it turns out that even if you make a dumb little app like that, you can basically harvest all sorts of data about the people that agree to use an app. And then in this particular case, because at the time that Dr. Kogan created this app, Facebook still allowed this, he was able to harvest the data of the friends of the people that used his app. So even though 270,000 people use the app, he was able to get a profile of about 50 million Facebook users. Some of the reports are 30 million or whatever. Stop me if you have a question. but so the this all breaks, and like I said, it sort of metastasizes. The whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, is got red hair. He's very telegenic. And so it was just sort of the perfect story. We can talk about this later, but it sort of intersected with so many different stories around tech and politics and geopolitical stuff that, boy, they did not succeed in their news dump.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. Like, first of all, they knew about this in 2015, and they didn't do anything about it. So that's part of the story, too. And then also their first response was so very reminiscent of Zuckerberg's first response when people accused him, you know, back in December of 2016, that, you know, Facebook might have had a role in the election. And he said, oh, that sounds crazy. You know, their first, not Zuckerberg's first response, but Facebook's. Some of Facebook representatives' first response was they took issue with the fact that the press was using the word leak and breach because it wasn't technically that, which was, I thought that was a weird part of the story as well.
Yeah, and then you had all of these Facebook executives that normally are not very vocal jumping on Twitter and saying that and then deleting their tweets. I mean, to give Facebook credit, like they said, this was not a situation where someone broke into their servers, stole people's passwords and things like that. This, from Facebook's point of view, they would say, you know, we were stolen from this guy made an app. He told us it was an academic app for academic purposes. And then he goes and sells this to this third party, Cambridge Analytica, which was against Facebook's rules. But as you point out, they didn't actually, if they knew, and, you know, Wiley's data that he shared with The Guardian especially shows that it seems like Facebook knew that Cambridge Analytica had these 50 million profiles, and they shouldn't have, and they didn't do anything to Cambridge Analytica in the 2 years that they knew about it. But then, right, and this is part of how it evolved. So you had Facebook's CSO, Alex Stamos. He, you know, this is controversial, but New York Times reported that he's going to leave amid disagreements with top execs over disinformation possibly related to this story and things like that. And I think that broke on Monday or Tuesday. And so it was just this rolling ball. And the fact that Facebook did not respond till yesterday, you sort of get the sense, I mean, you always do with Facebook, that they think that, you know, they get caught doing something that people don't like, they apologize, they wrap themselves on the knuckles, and then it all blows over. So I guess if that's happened to you so many times over the course of your life as a company, maybe you're never really aware of when, oh, this is bigger than we think it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you and I could have told you over the weekend that this was a bigger deal. So, you know, we can speculate on why it took so long to hear from them. But, you know, I think the Occam's razor thing is that they kind of hoped that this would blow over.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing that I'm hearing a lot of people talk about is, oh, you know, and Zuckerberg talked about it in many of his interviews, like, we don't do that anymore. We don't give third parties access to all of your friends' information. But I don't know if you know this is true. I don't know if anyone knows this is true, because Facebook is such a black box. But I know we talked to Kashmir Hill from Gizmodo about this, you know, 6 months ago. And as far as I know, they still give access to your social graph. Like, you still have access to your social graph. So maybe you're not, like, maybe if we're Facebook friends and, you know, you sign into an app with, you know, with your Facebook, they're not knowing that, like, I liked, you know, a post about In Excess yesterday, but they are knowing that we're friends and that we're connected. Mm-hmm. And I do think they still do that, which there's a lot of information just in that. I mean, just in the fact that we are friends and that, you know, my husband is not even on Facebook at all, but he's in people's contacts. And so if you have the Facebook app on your phone, then he's also part of that social graph, even though he's never even signed up for Facebook.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the funny thing about all this is that in the end, and a lot of people have pointed this out that are smarter than me, you know, the thing that Facebook, the thing that Facebook got caught with here was their business model working, because we know that Facebook sells ads against the fact that, you know, I'm a Liz Phair fan and Liz Phair is going on tour. And guess what? I got an ad about Liz Phair's upcoming tour date. So, yes, of course, their whole business is micro targeting and chopping up all of your, and, you know, it's the advertiser's dream that, you know, you used to have to try, if you wanted to sell a car, you tried to find TV shows that people that liked cars would watch or something like this. Well, now I will tell you the exact model of car that I like because I like it on Facebook. So, you know, I think part of the reaction to this is people realizing, I guess for years we've all known this. Sure, you run around the internet and these ads chase you and you're like, how do they know that? Oh, right, I like that on Facebook. But then when people connect the dots of, oh, somebody, and we don't know this, but let's assume that, you know, Russian trolls or whatever took that 50 million and did the sort of 50 million accounts, did the sort of slicing and dicing that, well, if someone liked, you know, an NRA post, then that might be someone that we could target ads to against Hillary Clinton. Or even, you know, I saw analyses of like they can down to brands, like, and I don't know that this is true, but if you like a certain brand of peanut butter, they can correlate that you're most likely to be on this part of the spectrum politically or in terms of various issues and things like that. And so I don't know. I think that the reaction to this has just been that a lot of people just connected the dots of, you know, when we thought they were doing this to us to sell laundry detergent, it was sort of amorphous. And yeah, we know that that's how it works. But I don't know. This just made it a little more real and tangible, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking for a while just the fact that they're really honing in on our neuroses and just like things. And yeah, okay, so maybe they'll give me an ad for something that I'm likely to buy because they know that I'm neurotic. Okay, but yeah, but if they're also giving me fake news stories about the presidential candidate, that is more worrisome. So,
but it's also realizing, you know, when people use the term big data, this is what they mean, that every time you're online, every time you're using an app, every time you're using a social network, you're basically throwing out tons and tons of data points that big data goes in and puts in databases and can harvest, and then smart people using machine learning and all these things, that all these buzzwords that we hear about, they can figure out who you are and they can market to you. And somehow we've sort of tacitly for the last 10 or 15 years accepted that we were being marketed to, that this was the big, you know, big data, big brother sort of thing, but it was just to sell us detergent. And I think that this is just waking people up and realizing that sort of whole system, this faceless but really complicated and really precise system, can be used for a lot of things. And by the way, it was used possibly for very nefarious things, just because Facebook might know everything about us, but apparently they didn't know a lot about what any app developer was using with the data that they collected.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's so complicated. My favorite example of this is just when people say, I think Facebook is listening to me through my microphone on my phone, mm-hmm. because I just was delivered this ad that I just was having this conversation about it, and I never searched for it, and I never, you know, and that's not true. It's simply, I mean, maybe it is, but it's highly unlikely. And what is really going on is much worse, is that they are looking at every like and every person that we're friends with and every like of theirs and every, you know, how often we,
and,
how fast
and
we
where
scroll.
You are, like, where are you right now? Certain apps know that, you mm-hmm. know, where have you been in the last hour? That sort of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're just taking that and crunching the numbers. So, okay. So last night, Zuckerberg talked to many people. I don't know if he talked to you, Brian. He did not return any of my phone calls. But, you know, he talked to Kara Swisher at Recode. He talked to CNN. And he basically used the words, I'm sorry, and apologize, and said, you know, we shouldn't be able to serve you if we, you know, don't do this. And we're going to be doing this, this, and this. But, I mean, is it too late in a lot of ways? That data is still out there. Like, it might be on the dark web. I don't know if I'm being like crazy and conspiracy theories to say that what's out on the dark web could from Facebook.
You know, that's funny. I had that exact same thought. I was wondering if like if just this one crazy app had 50 million profiles, then is there a market right now for other apps that have collected hundreds of millions? You know, I'm not qualified to even begin to hunt that stuff down. But, you know, I think, you know, they did what they had to do. They basically flooded the channels last night. You know, if you go to the New York Times, if you go to Recode, they can't. The story that they're going to have run with all day was the interview that they got. Mm-hmm. So that does definitely give them a pause for breath in terms of the news cycle. I'm actually, though, skeptical. I'm not saying that, you know, it's going to be as feverish as it's been this week, but I'm skeptical that this story is going to go away, because I have no way of knowing if the #deleteFacebook thing is getting traction. I mean, anecdotally, I'm seeing people actually deleting their Facebook account, but, you know, I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn, so it's sort of a different, really politically engaged demographic. But they did what they had to do, and I will give credit for Zuckerberg going on and being honest and taking his raps and things like that. He did kind of stick to the talking points of, we screwed up, we've got to do better, we are doing better. I think what they have done by giving people tangible things, supposedly they're going to put that tool at the top of the news feed so you can see what apps have, which you could probably already do now, but they're, you know, going to make that more prominent. And then I think the main thing is maybe you should be scrutinizing the apps that are on the platform and the developers behind those apps and what they're doing with the data. So hopefully that's the sort of thing that's coming forward. But a lot of people said, and I really think that this is the key point, is that one of the things that was disturbing last night was the times that Zuckerberg seemed to be like, well, why is this my job? Why is this my job? Specifically about I think it was with Kara talking about where's the line on hate speech? Like, who chose me to be the person to make those decisions? I mean, it's the with great power, great responsibility thing. Like, yeah, I didn't choose Mark to be the person that makes those decisions. But I really hope that he will learn that that is kind of going to be his role. Like, either you abdicate the power that Facebook has in all of our lives and walk away, or you realize the power that it has and you take that seriously. I don't know. It gets into the larger debate of all of these social media companies not wanting to admit that they're media companies or that they have to curate content and things like that. But go the Spider-Man route and realize the power that you have and take that seriously. Like, I hope that would be the thing that we start to see happening over the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I've heard Kara Swisher talk about Mark Zuckerberg and she knows him. And, you know, she really believes that he believes this stuff. He does want to make the world a better place. But he's yet created this company that he sort of lost control of what they're doing and has also, that's their business model. And, mm-hmm. It's a lot of the internet's business model, and even admitted in, I think, his CNN interview that he doesn't see that changing. And his reasoning is, you know, I would never have people pay for Facebook because there's some people who can't afford to pay for Facebook. And so I think he believes that, but I think that just the way the business model works is problematic and always will be.
Yeah, somebody tweeted the quote, and I don't remember where this quote is from, but you can never convince a man to do a thing if it's if he's paid, if he makes his living doing otherwise, you know. So that's their business model. And I said on the podcast today that they would have to really take a hard look and reassess some very fundamental things about Facebook to deal with any of these things that they're dealing with. I mean, you know, things like fake news, or data breaches, or personal privacy, or the 2016 election. Like, they would have to fundamentally decide, we're going to do something different than what we've done since the day this company was born.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the tech meme ride home. You guys are three weeks in, or is more less?
You know, it's been a blur. I think so. It's two and a half, maybe.
Okay. So it's a daily podcast. What time do you guys drop it?
I try to hit 5 p.m. Eastern, but, you know, if there's breaking news, we almost yesterday were going to push it back a bit because this news broke late. But, yeah, it's roughly 5 p.m. Eastern time. We call it the Tech Meme Ride Home, but, you know, obviously you can listen to it whenever you care to. But the idea, it's a 15 to 20 minute long show. It's supposed to be, this is what you missed when you were at work. Here's what happened today in the world of tech. You know, we do go into context, and, you know, I like to read, you know, tweets and different people's takes on the stories. But hopefully if you listen to the Tech Meme Ride Home in 15 minutes, I'll have caught you up and you'll be, educated enough to hold up your end of a conversation if you're going out for drinks that night with other people interested in tech stuff.
That's what I always say. Like, it's you know, you can hold your own at a cocktail party. By
exactly.
Well, and you are you still doing the Internet History Podcast, or is that on hold?
Still, oh no, that's still doing the Internet History Podcast. I just had Eugene Wei, most recent episode. But yeah, I interview people that made the internet happen, essentially, about 170 episodes at this point.
Awesome. Well, Brian McCullough, thank you so much for joining us. And download the Tech Meme Ride Home, available where all podcasts are given away. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. After the break, in case you missed it, Jeff Bezos has a new dog. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Getting a mortgage is a frustrating, time-consuming, terrible, horrible, very bad experience. But it doesn't have to be. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details, and then you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's also convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And it's powerful. So whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th home, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, your assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that is right just for you. Perfect. Just for you. Designed all for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/TWIT. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS. ConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. This week, while Mark Zuckerberg flailed another tech CEO, Jeff Bezos was busy walking a robot dog and breaking the scales of the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. Let's get to the dog story first. Always the dog story first. That's what I say. At the Mars Amazon Robotic Conference, Bezos was seen walking Spot Mini, the robot dog from Boston Dynamics, which is not owned by Amazon yet. Mars does not stand for the planet, but for the machine learning, home automation, robotics, and space exploration. Spot Mini can go 90 minutes on a charge, weighs just under 70 pounds, and can open a closed door. In other Bezos news, since Amazon stock has jumped over 40% in 2018, the CEO is not only the richest person in the world, but he is also $40 billion richer than any other person on Earth. It is rumored that Bezos can also open a closed door all by himself. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show. All you have to do is email us at tnw@twit.tv. You know, you can also email me directly. I'm at megan@twit.tv. I love emails. Send me a selfie. We haven't done that in a while, but I like to see your faces and see where you're listening or watching. So if you want to send a selfie, send it to tnw@twit.tv or megan@twit.tv, or you can tag me on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney, and subscribe to the show, twit.tv/TNW. You can listen to the Tech Meme Ride Home and Tech News Weekly. You can have both. We're very different. And so have both. Subscribe to both. Subscribe to all the rest of the shows on the Twit Network. You can get something good every day, I promise. Jason Howell will be back next week. If you want to find out what he's doing on vacation, you can find him at Jason Howell. You cannot find him on Facebook because he's gotten out of there long before the rest of us figured out we should too. Thank you to Josh, who has been sick this week but came anyway. Thank you to Bert. Thank you, Josh. If you're watching, you get to see him in his mask and gloves. He is not allowed to get near any of the rest of us or touch anything we're going to touch in the next 24 hours. Thank you to Burke for all that you do, all that you fix, and all that you break, especially the stuff that you fix that you've already broken. Thank you to John for his help. And thank you to Alex also, who helped so much today. Thank you most of all to you for joining us for Tech News Weekly. We'll see you next week.